Morning, how are you?
You well? Looking good. What day is it today? Sunday. What day is it today? April Fool's Day, very good. Have you caught anybody yet? If you haven't, then you've got just under 2.5 hours to do your darndest, but remember there's a switch at 12 midday. If you're not sure what that is, try and get someone out and let me know what happens next week. The best April Fool's Day that I was involved in came one year when my wife was fairly pregnant. You know, we were expecting our third child. I was getting nervous for a couple of reasons. One, our first child came 5 weeks early. That caught us out. And then the second one came super fast. Rob woke me at 4:15 a.m. He arrived at 4:45 a.m. Same day. And so I was getting a little apprehensive and I wanted to make sure everything was ready, so I prepared myself mentally, you know, what was the quickest route to the hospital, ensuring I had clothes to put on and to get to the hospital because the children come in the middle of the night. Who knows why, but they do. The car of petrol, all that sort of stuff was in place. And so I also talked to the small staff team that I was leading at the time, saying, you know, we need to be prepared because who knows when this child will come, how it will come. So I need you to be prepared to pick up things at the drop of a hat, and that might include a sermon. So have one in the back of your Bible just in case. And they said, sure, no problem. Well, I woke up one Sunday morning and I was strangely calm. You know, it was a morning like today. The sun filtered in through our dining room and I was looking pretty good and feeling okay and so on. And then it dawned on me. It was April 1. So I figured I was up. The sun was up. It was 6 a.m. What better time to make a phone call? Rang one of the staff. I said, "Right, John, it's all happening. You'll have to preach. I'll let you know what happens and when and so on. See ya." I hung up. And so I then took a leisurely breakfast. My wife came out, took one quick look at me and said, "What have you done?" Gave me a look when I told her, a look that normally causes the heart of a man to wither into nothing. But that didn't work this day because I had so much impish delight at what I was doing. And when I finished my breakfast, I called Ron back. "April Fool." To this day, I cannot understand Ron's response. He not only questioned the legitimacy of my birth, he did so with some vigour. And if I remind him of this little story, he goes into it again. Anyone and everyone is fair game, aren't they, on a day like today? Aging aunts, sleep-deprived spouses, children who are defenceless because they don't understand the ritual yet. If you were really caught out this year, no doubt you'll spend the next 12 months lying awake at night trying to work out, how do I get so-and-so back? And I'm going to put that in my diary and so on. Of course, there are times when being caught out is not so much fun, is it? Like there was the year when I was much younger and not so much wise, I applied for and got a job as a guitarist and a singer at a local restaurant to sit in the corner and play and sing. And I thought that I could do it, and so I thought one thing, and the whole restaurant thought a different thing. The sting of the shame and embarrassment of being a fool is quite acute. And if you follow Jesus, then there will be times when you will feel like a fool because we hold to a truth that others don't think much of. Like I was at a Bucks party for a clergyman friend. Quite a number of years ago, it was pretty much all clergymen at the table, so you can imagine the excitement there was at that night. Maybe not. And there was a hens night, and they weren't clergy people at that table, and they found out that we were a Bucks night, and they found out they were all clergymen, and it didn't help that we were Anglican clergymen, because that just, anyway. Their shock of discovering that we were Anglican clergymen, mixed with their excitement and the liquid that they were having that we did not have, led them to make all sorts of comment, questioning our manhood and our prowess and so on. And at moments like that, you wish someone had, that somehow spiritual powers would suddenly descend upon you and you'd have enough strength to stop the speeding car that you can imagine coming through the front of the restaurant. You could stop it with a word or your bare hands. And so then you would save everybody in the restaurant and then they would see that Christian manhood had something going for it. Instead, we just felt foolish.
And, you know, with this we know that we're part of a movement that is cruciform in nature, that is Christ-shaped, it's cruciformed, it's formed by the cross. And we also know that those who turn their back on this cross and the message of the cross, they turn their back on the God of grace. And so they're in need of grace, they're in need of mercy, but they refuse it. They turn their back on it and they are fools. What else could it be? On April Fool's Day, this one, whose fool are you? Either you reject Christ and his mercy and you become a fool in God's eyes, or you follow Jesus, accept his mercy, and become a fool in the eyes of humanity. Both fools experience the same stinging shame and embarrassment from time to time, but whose fool are we? And so today we begin a series entitled Cross Living. This series will be a little bit of like a checkup, you know, when you get to a certain age, and if you're not there yet, you soon will be, particularly if you respect your elders, that would be me, because I'm now of this age where the doctors want to check you up from time to time and not just look at the outside anymore. They want to poke and prod in places that shouldn't be poked and prodded. And anyway, they want to check that everything's right on the inside because you don't want any nasty surprises. You want to be well. And so we're going to spend our time the next few weeks in the book of 1 Corinthians. And it's a great place to have a checkup on how cruciform are we? How shaped are we by the cross of Jesus? The Corinthian church was an exciting church to go to. I have no doubt about that. According to chapter 1, verse 7, we're told they did not lack any spiritual gift. So there were orators and healers and miracle workers attending that church. There were gifted teachers and preachers. They were also there. According to chapter 1, verse 20, the scholars and the philosophers attended. In chapter 5 and chapter 6, we sense that there were men of great influence from the city who attended the church in Corinth. And in chapters 10 and 11, we discover that there were men of immense means attending this church. Not only did they have the excitement of their own preaching team, but according to chapter 1, verse 12, they also enjoyed the teaching and preaching from the who's who of the Christian circuit of the day. Apollos, Peter, they would come and preach in this church. It's a bit like if you're into this, you know, thinking that Mark Driscoll would turn up, followed by John Piper and then Keith Baker. The great ones are here. And they are. On top of this, this church was a church of pedigree. This was a church that was founded by the great Apostle Paul. If ever there was an exciting church to go to, it was the church in Corinth. You never knew who you might run into after church. You never knew what deals you could strike up as you did that after church going to Malachi's. And you just might be able to influence the principal of the local private school to let your child in, because that kind of thing could happen in a church that was exciting. And there's little doubt that the church met in the shadow of a very wealthy temple in Corinth. I had the opportunity once to go to ancient Corinth, only saw it at a bit of a distance, but the topography is down on the valley floor, or at least on the floor, is where ancient Corinth is, and behind it, overlooking all of Corinth, is a tabletop mountain. On that mountain was a massive temple, the ruins are still there, a massive temple, a pagan temple, that was so wealthy it could employ 1,000 temple prostitutes to serve both the men and the women of ancient Corinth. You can only guess what impact that sort of shadow would cast upon a church in a wealthy city. And now, as exciting as it was to be in Corinth, Corinth was not a well church. It got a little flabby, lost a little conditioning. Sexual immorality was applauded in the church. Lawsuits were common, as was gluttony, divisions, and greed. They were not as cruciform as they ought to have been. And so with all the patience of a good shepherd, the Apostle Paul sets about getting the church back in shape. Now, what he does in this historical book is a great service to us in the 21st century. As we look at what Paul did, there's an opportunity for us to do a health check on ourselves. Are we in shape? That's the question to ask. Are we cruciform? Are we shaped by the cross of Jesus? Or are we a little flabby? There are two telltale signs that a church gets a little flabby. Boasting about status and boasting about men. So let's look at these. Boasting about status. You can see this in what Paul addresses as you read through 1 Corinthians. Now, reading New Testament literature, particularly the letters, is often like listening to one side of a telephone conversation or reading just one part of an email chain. You can see what the issues are by what is addressed in the email or what you hear someone mention from your side. And so Paul says in chapter 1, verse 29, he says, so no one should boast before Jesus. And then he says in verse 31, if anyone boasts, they should boast about the Lord. It's clear that there was a boasting going on by the people who attended the church at Corinth. They were boasting about their own track record, their status. And you get a bit of a clue as to exactly what they were boasting about if we look at verse 20, where Paul says, so where is the wise man? Where is the scholar? Where is the philosopher of this age? Or verse 26, where he says, brothers, think of what you were when you were called. Not many of you were wise by human standards, not many were influential, not many were of noble birth. And so as we read 1 Corinthians, we see that the currency of Corinth was education, philosophy, influence, position, and wealth. These were the currencies existing in the church in Corinth. And not a whole lot has changed in the last 2,000 years. I've picked up over the years that while there is a kingdom of Kellyville and I live therein, there are better lands. The land of Castle Hill. The land of Dural. The land of Bella Vista. I've discovered that when you're talking to people, I've observed, if you're talking to people and you mention the name that the name of the school that your children goes to and the kind of fee level you pay, if you get a raised eyebrow from the person you're talking to, you have status. It's not enough to be an assistant manager in an organization. You have to be a manager or a general manager or the chief of something or other in the organization. The car you drive, the label you wear, the number of Facebook friends you have, the number of followers on Twitter, which mobile phone you have, Android, Apple, smart or dumb. These things determine, well, what else could it be if it's not smart? These things determine your status. These are currency in our world. Such boasting in these things tends to have an effect on how we view the world. That is, the world owes me. And so, it tends to shape how we view other human beings. They should follow me. They should listen to me. They should fulfill my wishes. Boasting about status was not limited to... the boasting was not limited to status, but also extended to the boasting of men. Now, this reflected a particular mindset in the city of Corinth, in fact, the ancient world in the first century, of the patron-client system of operating. The patron was often wealthy and influential, someone that you serve, someone you would get to know, someone that you ingratiate yourself to. Because if you could get their favor, then life would be better for you. If you were a free man, it may mean a better status, more connections, more networks. If you were a slave, your patron just might buy your freedom. To a lesser degree, that kind of thing still happens in our city of Sydney. People clamour to be next to the latest and greatest. People would love to be at dinner parties with one of the Packers, the Murdochs or Dick Smith, because you never know what might come of that. In Corinth, this sort of desire found expression in words that we see in chapter 1, verse 12, where Paul says, one of you says, I follow Paul. Another says, I follow Apollos. And another, I follow Cephas or Peter. And another, I follow Christ. I listen to Mark Driscoll. I listen to John Piper. And when you mention those things, it should bring hushed tones. As we read through the Corinthian letter, there's every indication that this is taking pride in another man, so that we could judge their oratory skills and their charismatic personality. And so, were they eloquent, schooled? Were they well qualified? Do they have a master's degree, a PhD? Can they hold a congregation? Are they motivational speakers? The boasting, the pride was aimed at putting yourself in a good light. Paul actually uses the word hubris in 1 Corinthians chapter 4. And hubris is more than just pride on steroids. It's using your power and your energy to indulge yourself. Well, of course, I only prefer to listen to Apollos, and I had coffee with him the other day, personally, man on man. I ran into Mark Driscoll once. He called me sir. That's actually true. Paul says in 1 Timothy chapter 4, verse 6, "Now, my brothers, I have applied these things to myself and to Apollos for your benefit, so that you may learn from us the meaning of the saying, 'Do not go beyond what is written.' Then you will take no pride." That's the word hubris. You will take no hubris in one man over against another. And the boasting in Corinth reached such a level that the church at Corinth fought Paul, almost to the point of rejecting him altogether. I can only imagine that that would be like that 37-year-old man, I think his age was, on the coast here somewhere, who poured petrol over his stepmother and set her on fire during the week. Did you see that in the news? He rejected her. The church got close to rejecting Paul. And so Paul writes to them in 1 Corinthians chapter 2, verse 1, "When I came to you, brothers, I did not come with eloquence or superior wisdom, as I proclaim to you the testimony about God." And the boasting of men also meant that as you aligned yourself with the influential and the wealthy, judgment was clouded. So you get to chapter 5 and we discover that one man in the church was so revered in the marketplace that when he slept with his father's wife, no one said anything. No one said anything. Everyone knew, but no one acted. And Paul says in chapter 5, verse 2, in fact, he says to the church, "You're proud of the fact that this man slept with his father's wife." You know, people were saying, yeah, I know he slept with his father's wife. I know him. I had coffee with him. He's a generous man. He doesn't mean any harm. But it wasn't his blood mother. It was his father's wife, his second or third wife. So that's kind of okay, isn't it? And no one would challenge this man, because to challenge him or to correct him, that wouldn't go well for us, because we might lose something if he took off. Now, I'm not sure about you, but I want to press pause for a moment. We're talking about a Christian church here. This is a church that had accepted Jesus' mercy and his grace, but she clearly is not healthy. It got a little flabby. She's out of shape. And so it's an opportunity as we look back 20 centuries and go, let's do a check on ourselves, shall we? Because you wouldn't want anyone to get a hold of anything in 20 centuries time from us and go, man, the church at Castle Hill, that was a little flabby. So, Paul walks right into the middle of this church, so to speak. He walks right into the middle and he holds up a figure so offensive, so shocking, so otherworldly, it immediately shows their flab. Chapter 2, verse 2, "I resolved to know nothing while I was with you except Jesus Christ and him crucified." Now, friends, that's about as attractive as seeing a young woman walk into our church this morning with a freshly cut off ear or nose on her neck on a gold chain. Only it's much, much, much worse. No one in the first century, the second century, the third century, or the fourth century wore little gold crosses around their neck on little gold chains. There was far too much blood and offense associated with crucifixion for anybody to do that. And we find the crucifixion scene, don't we? Like, who saw The Passion of the Christ, Gibson's Passion? Did you enjoy the scourging scenes and the crucifixion scene? You know, I've shown photos in this church since, People don't like those scenes. I don't like those scenes. I saw that movie 4 times, took 3 people I know who don't know Jesus in the hope that it would help them come. One of them had to leave the movie theater during that movie. I cannot watch that movie again. I bought the DVD in the hope that I might be able to. I can't watch it. And as graphic as Gibson made things in that movie, my reading of history is what he presented was a Sunday school picnic compared to a real crucifixion. You look at a real crucifixion and you wonder how a human being could do such a thing to another. It is brutal. It is inhumane. And knowing that it was only reserved for the worst of criminals does not help take away the obscenity. To suggest that a victim of crucifixion was a hero, that his death was noble, would be to say, you're insane. To preach Christ crucified was to combine insanity with insensitivity. It's as if we would walk into a synagogue and say, hey, what Hitler did was right and noble. And, you know, Tony Abbott would make a great prime minister. Oh, sorry, that should have been Julie Gillard. He's a great prime minister. The insanity of it all, and it goes on into eternity, the brutality and the offense of his crucifixion will be with Jesus forever. The last book of the Bible tells us that Jesus appears to us as the firstborn from the dead. He looks like a lamb that has been slain. Forever he will bear the scars on his hands, his feet and his side from the crucifixion. Forever we will gaze on the face of him who was crucified. And Paul marches into the church at Corinth, a church hooked on status, one that craved honor and glory, that longed to be wise and to be regarded as wise, and he elevates a crucified man. They reel, they're horrified, they're offended. How could he? How dare he? This is a church. And all the while, God is showing the church at Corinth and us just how flabby the church at Corinth had become. One scholar says, no wonder the church at Corinth sought to escape the crucified Christ into an enthusiastic life of the Spirit, heavenly revelations, and exciting displays of power. For there is no sting of shame. But with the crucified one, there is offense and obscenity and shame. You see, the thinking and the practices of the secular world had contaminated the church at Corinth. And whenever the message of the cross of Jesus is ignored by a church gets a little out of shape. The church at Corinth was bankrupt. They tolerated sexual immorality. They tolerated the lack of loving relationships and divisions because they scorned the message of the cross. And the crucified God exposes all of that silliness. If ever God left his thumbprint anywhere on this planet, it was on the cross that Christ was crucified on. See what Paul writes in chapter 1, verse 21, halfway through. God was pleased through the foolishness of what was preached to save those who believe. Jews demand miraculous signs and Greeks look for wisdom, but we preach Christ crucified, a stumbling block to the Jews, and foolishness to Gentiles. But to those whom God has called, both Jews and Greeks, Christ the power of God and the wisdom of God. The message of the cross is God's wisdom and his power. It's his wisdom because God solved a problem that faced every man, woman, and child. The problem is we are sinners, we are born in sin, we cannot help but sin, and sin must be punished. But the problem is when we pay the punishment of sin, when we receive the punishment, we live no more because the punishment of sin is death and hell. And yet God could not leave us like that. He created us. He wants us to live with him. And so out of his mercy, he solves a problem. How do I save these people who will go to hell if I do not save them? How do I do this? How do I do this? He sends a scapegoat, a whipping boy in the form of his son Jesus and has him crucified. No other faith thought of this because no other faith could. No philosopher or scholar thought of it because they could not. But God, the only wise one, solved the problem by sending Jesus to the cross. The cross is also the power of God because it boasts the cleansing power of sin in Jesus' blood. Jesus' blood alone is powerful enough to cleanse us and bring us salvation. And the cross forms community. You see it in verse 26. Brothers, think of what you were when you were called. Not many were wise by human standards. Not many were influential. Not many were of noble birth. But God chose you. He's drawn you in. He's formed a new people with you. So while Jesus looks weak and impotent to the secular world, when he is derided and ridiculed in schools and universities, businesses and in the media, the truth is that Jesus has become our wisdom. He is our righteousness, our holiness. He is our redemption. And so, if we are to boast in anything, let our boast be not about our credentials or which preachers we listen to or what people we know, but let our boast be cruciform. That is, let our boast be about Jesus, according to verse 31. Let him who boasts, boast in the Lord. When a church so boasts, when a church is cruciform, there's a wonderful change that takes place. Instead of boasting about position and power, instead of using position and power for self-indulgence, the one who follows Jesus, the one who is shaped by the cross, uses position and power to advance others to Jesus. A cruciform people are like the one who hung on a repulsive, sickening cross. And so they leverage everything at their disposal. Education, position, finance, influence, status, networks, and resources. They leverage everything so that as many as possible might become like us, recipients of mercy, enjoying the life of a cruciform people. And so like Jesus taught in the Gospels, when we have barbecues and dinner parties at home, it's not simply our friends who come, but because we're cruciform, we include others, people from all levels of society, people like the poor, the lame, the blind, the single, the intellectually challenged, the multicultural, and it'd be multicolored with black, brown, brittle, and white skins all turning up. A cruciform people are a safe people. No one is taken to court or left hungry in a cruciform-shaped church. No one allows sexual immorality to be tolerated in a cruciform church. Sin is dealt with. A cruciform people will bring people to Jesus, you see. Whether they do that in their office or in the street or at school or university sporting club, they will seek people out and bring them to Jesus because we boast of Jesus, not a man, not our position. And all of that, my friends, lies behind our mission here to bring people to Jesus, build them up in Jesus, to send them out for Jesus. No longer will people say, well, I know the Prime Minister had coffee with her the other day. I know so-and-so. But rather they say, I know Jesus Christ. And if you would like, I could introduce him to you. A cruciform people will continue to get behind ministries like 421, Primetime, Crossfire, The Big Thing, Ginger House, Gingerbread House, Men's Ministry. Don't settle down, women. There's no Gingerbread House thing on, okay? I know you go into a thing there. But you stay, and we get behind Jammer. We get behind the Cantata. We invite people to listen, not to the music necessarily, though the music is good. We'd invite people, more importantly, to listen to the message because it's the message of the cross which brings people to Jesus. And the message of the cross is offensive, and you know, like it is the Easter cantata. It is about the death and resurrection of Jesus. And so the message is offensive, but we will still invite people because at the cross there is hope. Our staff, our core leaders, our parish council are giving themselves to this mission. In fact, parish council last week, its first meeting for the year, put a very serious question before themselves and asked, in the light of the gospel, in the light of the message of the cross, if we are serious about being a cruciform people, what will we look like in 10 years from now? What will this church look like in 2022? Where will we be meeting in 2022? And so I have a question. What about you? What will you give yourself to? Whose fool are you? Are you rejecting the message of the cross and so being a fool in God's eyes? Or are you accepting the message of the cross and running the risk of being a fool in men's eyes? After looking at the church at Corinth, are you in shape? Or have you let yourself go a little? Let's make sure we allow the cross to shape us, because we are to be a cruciform people who will gladly be fools for Christ.